Now, back to the Midday Grind with Martin and Marlo on 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM, and InsideSTL.com.
Hey, back with you on 590 The Fan, Martin Kilcoyne, Chuck Marlo. I told you, it's a big photo day here at 590 The Fan. Charlie Marlo is out, but Charlie Army is with us, the former general manager of the Rams, longtime NFL executive. Great to be with him last night at a Dick Vermeil event, and he also had a golf tournament with Coach Hanifin earlier this week. So back in the STL. Charlie, how did it feel to be back in St. Louis?
It felt great. I kind of miss St. Louis. I miss the people in the community, and I live in, out in Arizona now, but it's not like being in St. Louis. And we really grew to love it there. And, of course, the Barracuda misses it even more than I do.
Is that what didn't the bear? By the way, the Barracuda is Charlie's wife. For years, I would say, hey, can you do our Sunday show? Can I meet you for lunch? He said, I got to check with the Barracuda. When did she earn that title?
Well, long, many years ago, she was always, telling me to do this, telling me to do that. And a couple of years ago, though, I think I told her, I think now you've graduated, you're all encompassing, so now you're going to be Mother Superior.
Well, Charlie, it's,
she's had that name, and we've been married 55 years. She's had that name for 50 of them, at least.
Well, and a football life for her, I was thinking about this, you just move and you move when you're a coach or you're a scout. Can you even think off the top of your head, how many different places have you and the Barracuda lived?
Well, I've been with 5 different NFL teams, and then I coached in high school, and then I coached in college before that. In fact, Jack Elway, John Elway's father, and I coached together at Montana, so we've made a lot of moves over the years, and she's just been precious and dealt with it. And actually, I think she enjoys sports as much or more than I do. She's extremely into the Blues, into the Cardinals. Last night, she didn't go with me because she wanted to watch the Cardinal game. So she was so excited when they won 9-2. So anyway, she's really into the St. Louis scene, and I appreciate that. And you couldn't ask for a better wife when you're in the NFL as an executive or a coach.
Here's something I didn't realize. You had spent those 7 years with the New England Patriots before you joined the Rams when Dick Vermeil came on board. And so the Super Bowl happens after the 2000 season, of course, or the 2001 season, rather, Super Bowl 36, where the Rams lose to the Patriots. And on the other side of it, those were a lot of players that you were key to bringing to New England. It came back to bite you.
Yeah, 24 actual players on their roster yet when they played, because including the kicker. I went over to Europe and signed the kicker, and NFL, I think it's from South Dakota State, I believe. But anyway, I went over there, signed him, and when the game was over, I said, that's one trip I probably shouldn't have made.
Adam Vinatieri you're talking about, yeah.
Right, Adam, yeah. But anyway, and the middle linebacker I signed out of Colorado. But it was a lot of the players, and it was bittersweet. Of course, I would have been much better for me and for my psyche had we beat them with the players that we brought to St. Louis. So we were a better football team, but that's why they play the games. The better team doesn't always win.
Well, and some people, I would say, over the course of time have said, well, you know what? That was the coming out party for Bill Belichick, for Tom Brady, and I think for some people, they're at peace with it. I'm wondering for you, though, are you still looking at – if you talk to Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, they still say, boy, that group we had, we probably should have won at least one more Super Bowl. That's hard to do, but a number of those players still lament that. Where are you in terms of being over it?
Well, I'm pretty much over it because you learn in this business to move on fast. And, I think if Dick Vermeil would have stayed, and this is not against Mike March, but it was a Dick Vermeil football team. And it was establishing his image. And then whenever you change the head coach, certain things change. And then it doesn't make any difference. If you remember Green Bay years ago, they had a great football team. And then Lombardi retired, and the guy that had the same team the next year, he couldn't hardly win a ball game. So what happens is the culture changes with the football team, and it doesn't make a difference how good a football coach you are. If the culture changes a little bit, it's even more difficult to win. But I think we had a good enough football team. We could have won one or maybe even two more Super Bowls because the team stayed together for about 3 years. But who knows? Those things are strange to have. But what people don't realize about that game, New England was even lucky to be in it. It could have been
Raiders, right?
The Raiders, because remember the tuck rule?
Yep.
You put 10 people in a room and they all look at that play, and half of them are going to say it's a tuck rule, half of them are going to say it's a fumble. And so everything has to bounce right for you to win the Super Bowl, and it certainly did for New England that year. So you put those things behind you and you look forward and just remember all the good parts about that season, the good things about the players that we had, and the really good job that Mike did with the run and shoot offense that we were running at the time, one of the fastest game on turf. So, and Mike did an outstanding job with the talent that we had as an offensive coordinator and as a head coach. So, but you know those things. Sometimes the ball doesn't bounce your way. You've seen it in every sport. I've seen hockey games when the goalies make stuff that you can't believe they ever made, and then they let in the goal that I could stop. So those are strange things about sports, and that's why we play the games, because somebody's going to play good, somebody's going to rise to the occasion, and win. You take New England. In our game, we probably were a better team. You take them when they played Seattle. If they run the ball in that play, they probably lose to Seattle. And last year, all that Atlanta had to do was run the ball twice, kick the field goal, and the game was over. So you never know how the ball bounces. So the one thing magical, I think, about the Patriots is the fact that Bill Belichick is so consistent with what he does and his approach to the game. And the players have learned to play the game in his image, just like they did here when Dick Vermeil was our head football coach. And got to go to work. That was, remember the old themes?
Oh, yeah. I can still hear Smash singing it, I believe. Charlie Army, former Rams general manager with us, as we look back at the 99 team, while it was kind of magical, and it was out of nowhere, they win, not only 13 games, then win the Super Bowl in dramatic fashion. But if you look back now, it wasn't really like a Cinderella story or a fluke. You know, you had Holt, Bruce, Pace, Faulk. You had Grant Wistrom. You had, Kevin Carter. I mean, that was a really loaded roster. So it wasn't, it surprised us because we didn't expect it to happen. But really looking back, it wasn't any kind of fluke.
Yeah, it was an amazing football table. You had all the parts of the puzzle there. And just think of how great Kurt Warner was. And if Trent Green hadn't gotten hurt, Trent Green would probably have been up on the stage. And Kurt, as great as he was, would have probably been Trent Green's backup for 3 or 4 years. But you never know how things are going to bounce in football. And we loved both quarterbacks. And when I went over to NFL Europe and watched Kurt play, there wasn't any doubt in my mind. And when I called Dick from Europe and told him we have a player here, he was so excited. And Dick Vermeil, God bless him, he just believed in Kurt from watching him in practice. And when Trent got hurt, there was a lot of sentiment that we need to go out and get somebody who's been in the NFL and has played, like Jeff Ostetler, Jeff Jork. Those names came up, and the coach just said, no, we've invested our time and everything into Kurt. We've watched him, we like him, and we're playing with him. So that ended that conversation in about 5 minutes in our staff room after Trent got hurt.
What was your level of surprise, disappointment, whatever it was at the time? You win the Super Bowl after a couple of down years, 97, 98. It all comes together. You win the Super Bowl, and then coach walks away. Dick Vermeil quits. What was your reaction? Do you remember where you were in the building when that came down?
Well, when Dick announced that he was going to quit,
yeah,
I was at dinner with him the night before he announced it, trying to talk him out of it. But I just felt, it takes so hard to change the culture of a football team. When I went to New England, they'd had back-to-back 1 in 15 years, And so, and then we went to the Super Bowl the last year I was there. So it takes so much to change the culture and the attitude and everything of the football team. And when you change the catalyst, the guy who made that change, then you wind up having to do it all over again. And that isn't any reflection on anybody other than the fact that this is a team that was made in his likeness. You know what Dick Vermeil's done. He's made teams every place he's been. So it was a disappointment, but then we just moved forward.
Are you in New England? We're working with Bill Parcells. Then there's a Bill Belichick. These guys are all kind of wired similarly. Very successful coaches seem to have this intense persona. Some might even say smug, or they can be rude at times. But then you get a guy like Vermeil, who's just like the real deal, nice to everybody, is friends with the janitor. Why do you think that's such a rarity in the NFL? That, you know, a lot of the guys who do well tend to be just so intense, not always real pleasant. Why do you think that personality? Why can't we have more Vermeils who are nice guys that also win?
Yeah, you know, it's just a difference in philosophy. I remember when Coach Parcells was an assistant coach at Army, at the U.S. Army Academy, and he and Bob Knight were there together. They bought into the book, Win by Intimidation, and everybody does it different. And so, you know, I went with Forrest Gregg, Chuck Knox, Bill Belichick, Bill Parcells, the best all-around coach in every area was Dick Vermeil. And he just treated everybody so well. You'd go over to he and Carol would be cooking dinner, and you'd see John Shaw at one table and our janitor at the next. And he treated everybody as family, and it paid off and showed up. Players learned to realize that he was the most sincere person that they ever played for. He never tried to con him. He always was straight up and honest with them. And the players know when they're not treating them honest and fairly. So he was just the most rounded and best coach I ever worked with. So that was a privilege for me to be here and a privilege for me to be part of the organization. And we had a lot of good people in this organization, and John Shaw did a wonderful job. Jay Zygmunt did a great job. It was just a good family when Dick was the matriarch.
Former interim head coach of the Denver Gold. That doesn't get brought up a whole lot. Charlie Army is with us, longtime NFL executive, former Rams general manager. So as a career scout, somebody with an eye on talent, give me one or two names that you're really proud of, that you drafted or stood on the table and fought for that person and said, this kid's going to be a great player. And then maybe one or two are like, oh, crap, don't bring that name up.
Well, there are always one or two of them in a ladder category, because if you're not trying to reach out and beat the odds, you probably aren't really trying. You know, just to give you an interesting story, I was with Atlanta when we drafted Brett Favre, and he was a total bust for us at Atlanta. And then Ron Wolf comes along and trades us for him, and he goes on to Green Bay and becomes just a legendary player. So sometimes it's luck, and sometimes it's the atmosphere you're working with, stuff like that. But you know, maybe the one I'm probably the most proud of is London Fletcher, because he played 18 years, never missed a game, and he came out of that small school in Cleveland. When I got his tapes and studied his tape, I put them in my desk drawer, and I got the scouts room. I said, none of you guys are going to look at this tape. None of you guys are going to talk about London Fletcher, and none of you guys are going to tell anybody about him, because he's 5'7", and he's good enough to play in his league. And if you tell anybody, they're going to be telling everybody about this player. So I said, we're not going to do anything. We're going to sign him to a free agent contract, because nobody will draft a 5'7" middle linebacker. And that's what happened. And when I signed him, he sat across from the table with me. He says, Coach, by the end of the year, I'll be your starting middle linebacker. We played San Francisco the last game, and he had 17 tackles. So the rest is history. Those kind of stories are great stories to remember. And then Trunk Candidate. I always contribute Trunk's failure to that. I don't know. You were probably at the practice when we were up at training camp when he got the horse collar tacker when we were working with Tennessee. And he never was a very good player after that. I don't know what that did to him, but. So he was probably as big a bust because he was a first-round pick.
And at the time, it surprised everybody because Marshall Faulk is an MVP-caliber player, and you guys took Trung. Was the idea there, hey, running backs don't last forever, we got to be ready?
Yeah, the whole idea was with Trung and his speed. And he, you know, he was pretty good at catching the ball in backfield. And the whole idea was to keep the offense as balanced as it was at that point. We just felt that Trung Candidate was the key. If we lost Marshall Faulk, you know, Marshall had had a couple little knee nicks at the time. So if we lost Marshall Faulk, that's the same kind of a reasoning when we decided to take Torrey Holton. Everybody thought we were taking Champ Bailey. But when the coaches were sat down and visited with myself and Coach Vermeil, we knew that if we took Torrey Holt, Isaac Bruce was going to be better because Torrey Holt was going to bring up the level of play on our offense, and they're not going to be able to shut Isaac off because now they got to pay attention to Torrey. Then we got to add Isaac Keefe. So it's a balance thing, and it's really a difficult thing when you're a personnel guy or when you're the head coach like Nick was, the balance to get the right players in the right place. Another player we got that year out of free agency, but he tended to forget and made a huge difference, was Adam Timmerman. He made a huge difference in our offensive line, solidifying our offensive line. So it's a whole idea, putting the whole thing together, knowing where we're balancing how you spend your salary cap money and to protect things. People don't realize if you get overloaded in the salary cap, say you lose a $10 million player, and there's a lot of them now, the problem is you can't replace it because you don't have another $10 million to go find another $10 million. So you're replacing him with a $500,000 player. So you got to be careful in how you balance your salary cap and how you balance your statement. You got to have a left tackle, and that's Orlando. You got to have the left tackle. And, of course, everybody knows you got to have a quarterback. You got to have the running back. You got to have the wide receiver. You got to have the defensive end. Well, we had two, Grant Wistrom and Carter. So, you know, getting the right players in the right places is the key to that success.
My favorite nugget about Charlie Army, his last name's Army, but he joined the Navy. That had to be weird when you were in the Navy and they would call roll call and you were one of the first names. Army, Army, yep, here for the Navy.
When I was in boot camp, some guy came through our facility where we were all, and I was laying on my bunk. He said, "What's your name, son?" And I told him Army. He said, "Oh, we got a smart ass in here too." So I was doing KP for about 2 days before he figured out I was telling the truth.
Oh, Charlie, so, great to be with you this week and to see you again, and all the best to your family and the Barracuda.
Yeah, and just to tell we love the fans there. We love the Blues and the Cardinals. And we'll always be part of St. Louis in our heart.
Thanks so much, Charlie.
Thank you.
All right, Charlie Army, former Rams executive there who helped put that roster together. You know, Leonard Little was a third-round pick. Oz Akeem, I think, was fourth round. Roland Williams, fourth-round pick. They pieced that thing together. A lot of fun to hear some stories with Charlie. And in terms of Vermeil, and it's not quite story time because we really chewed up a lot of time yesterday with story time on Majerus.
People love that stuff.
But I remember some Vermeil stories from players. And they said every Monday or every Tuesday, whatever day, probably Mondays, he would have them together for like a team meeting. And he would always tell a story about a former player, somebody that he really liked. And he would be like, "He is a great kid. He busted his ass. He became a great player." And he tells this real inspirational story. But he'd done that a couple of weeks in a row. And so now the players are like, "Oh, God, here we go again, Coach. I get it. You're going to tell us about this." So he brings up a name from a couple of years ago. "You remember so-and-so?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah." He goes, "What a piece of crap he was." And he just shifted the whole. It was a different vibe, a different story. They said, "We couldn't get him to do squat. What a loser." And he just goes on this whole tirade. And the players start laughing and clapping because they were like, "Oh, here we go again. Somebody's a great player, a great character." And he just knew. And that's what La Russa would do, too. You would shift the conversation, keep people off guard. Charlie has rejoined the conversation. We go from my two favorite Charlies, Army and Marlowe.
What about Tuna?
Charlie Tuna is in the house, too. That's true.
"Of course, you don't like me, man. I wonder why that is."
Love. Why don't we put you? You should get your own show with Charlie Tuna.
That'd be fun.
Chuck and Chuck.
It'll probably happen eventually.
Yeah. Weeknights. And by weeknights, we mean midnight.
You guys could play one of those games we come up with and just call it Chuck It.
Chuck It. Yeah.
I like that. But, you know, Martin, back in the day, did his news talk show.
Back in the day, way back in the day.
Technically, it wasn't just you. You had Randy Naughton. And you had what? You had producers, board ops types.
Some great folks.
I don't think I would ever, in all honesty, I don't think I would ever want to host a show by myself. That's just too much talking for one person. I don't have that much to say.
Well, and I will say, if you listen to a Jim Rome or a Rush Limbaugh or any of these people, whether you like what they're saying or not, it is a talent. It's a different skill to, like, argue with yourself and have a conversation with yourself. I prefer banter. I think most people prefer banter, but there are people who are really good at it. I heard you and Doug, a little pre-show, this is a little sign of wow. things to come, just going bonkers over some stats, and it was embarrassing for the both of you. I mean, it was way too much
disagree.
Sports information.
Disagree. And I'm actually
they were like
funny.
Screaming at each other about home runs. Like, oh, shut up. Take it to 101. My God, what are you doing?
It's funny you mentioned that because I just looked up the year-by-year major league averages because I was curious about our argument in terms of more home runs, a less focus on batting average, more of a focus on slugging. And I'll just throw it out here. We won't get into it a ton. I'll make sure I tweet at Doug once I look at all this info. Here's a good stat for you. 2017, across Major League Baseball, what do you think the batting average is for all of Major League Baseball? The league average, all teams.
All teams?
Correct. I hope Doug's listening. Just take a guess.
270.
255 in 2017. Now, let's just go back 10 years. I'm just picking that randomly. I haven't even looked to see. 268. So over the course of a decade, batting average across the entire league has dropped 13 points. Strikeouts in 2007, 6.62 per game. 10 years later here in 2017, 8.25. That's a big jump.
More
home
strikeouts.
Runs are up. Strikeouts are up. Batting average is down.
Nobody cares about batting average. We're hearing players start to say that.
But what's Doug's contention, though?
The whole idea is kind of launch angle. And Doug says, well, everybody for years has been teaching an uppercut swing, Ted Williams, the science of hitting, which I agree with. However, in the StatCast era, I know we joke about it, but since 2015, they have been monitoring every single exit velocity and launch angle. And yesterday, we were trading back and forth some tweets. The fact that Francisco Lindor, in his first three seasons, 15, 16, 17, his batting average has went down every year, his launch angle has went up every year, and his home runs have went up every single year. So clearly there...
Has it gone up? Has it went up? I don't know.
Who cares? Either way, my point is, he is sacrificing batting average.
Correct.
Increasing his launch angle, and he has 30-plus home runs this year.
How does the Tommy Pham hit 300 then because... He's swinging more, if this theory is correct, right?
Well, no, this is a theory across Major League Baseball. There's always going to be the greatest hitters in the league, the Joey Vottos of the world, who still hit above 300, are on base 450, 460. But I'm talking about all across baseball, there's just so many more hitters now that are more the type of guys who hit 240, hit 20-plus home runs, strike out a ton, and walk a ton. And that was a graphic I saw last night in Major League Baseball Network, where basically this year, there's 16 players in baseball that have 25-plus home runs with lower than a 250 batting average. And that's like four times the amount that we've seen over the past 40 years. That's not a small jump. That's
what is
four times.
So what's Doug's argument with you? What is the contention?
Doug has no argument.
Does he say, oh, they're all juicing, I'm sure of it. I remember this has happened before. The ball lands on Mars. They're all big freaks.
So he thinks the ball's juiced?
Yes, I think that's his main argument. He thinks the ball is juiced. I'm just showing you stats here.
855, 282, 82, 55.
My point is, let me ask you guys this. You guys all love baseball. Schaefer, you're a stat head. If the ball is juiced, wouldn't you think that batting averages would be increased? Correct?
If the ball is juiced.
Well, here's
if the ball is hit harder,
more
you would
likely,
think there would be more base hits. And that's not the case because batting averages have dropped over 10 years from a league average of 268 to 255.
Well,
and it's been a steady decrease for a decade.
I would ask, could the perfect storm be brewing as to where strategy has changed while also, you know, a change in the ball? So
maybe
where the approach has changed at the same time, another factor enters into the equation, and it's maybe not just one thing or the other. Maybe it's a combo.
I would look at this data, and you see that strikeouts have went up over 10 years, basically 6.62, 6.77, 6.91, 7.06, 7.10. It has incrementally went up for 10 years. To me,
right.
That does not point to a
gone
baseball
well,
all of a sudden being juiced in one season.
Here's what I would say. I'm inclined to believe by my gut that it's both. What I do know is we know there's a change in approach, a concerted change and strategy. That I do know is part of the equation. What you're talking about is most certainly part of it.
Correct.
What Doug is saying, I tend to believe is part of it as well, but I don't necessarily have the proof of that. That's how I would approach it at this point.
I think personally, I would have liked all these stats better if you would have done it in the Majerus voice. That's all. I mean,
We'll do that from now on.
I was actually driving yesterday, and we were playing that Oasis song yesterday. You know, I said maybe, and I found myself in the car. I was doing the lyrics. I said maybe. you're going to be the one that saves me. And then I did Spags, and this is how I kind of pass my time as I'm driving to work.
See, I like that.
This show gets in your brain.
I don't even take Manchester anymore because of Martin. I had down Woodlawn.
You went to Nacho Mama's today.
I did go to Nacho Mama's.
You were right next to Crazy Bulls and Rav.
Oh, trust me. I know that, Martin. You told me in my head while I was driving.
Yep. Just up from Ferrado's. Used to be a Schlotsky's. Then you've got Lulu's. And you got Hacienda on the left. There's the CC's before you get to the Penn Station. Charcoal House. Man, what a row that is.
Every time I go by Lulu's, I think of Chuck.
I'd rather talk about this.
Well, it's a dumb show, but I sure love it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Clip that
One
off.
More stat for you real quick. Oh, and now boy. We have to break. Was anybody talking about juice balls last year? Or is it pretty much a this year phenomenon? But here we go. 2015, home runs per game, 1.01. It jumped to 1.16 in 2016. It jumped to 1.26 this year. Actually, a much bigger jump last year and the year before from 2014 to 2015. However, you only hear it being talked about, for the most part, this season. There have been way more juice ball talk and discussion this year than there ever was the last couple of years. The data does not support that.
I think,
wow.
Boom, roasted, let's break.
And I'm the stat head?
Yeah.
I love stats. I've always loved stats.
There's no issue with it.
Again, this show and 590 is all about creating a false narrative decades ago and then just keep playing on that narrative for years
pot
and years.
Him down.
And years.
Shake
they call them cybermetrics.
That's what we do here.
Turk down. Hey, a little later, let's get the guy that went nuts about stats and sabermetrics.
He's awesome.
Yes.
This New York Sports Talk Radio guy. He's
After
fantastic.
Chuck just spit out a bunch of numbers at us. Let's mock that.
These aren't numbers. These are like, I'm talking basic numbers that every baseball fan, your mom knows. She knows strikeouts, home runs, batting average.
Like she's still mad at
Carpenter.
This is
the furthest thing from sabermetrics.
Like the Tango Tiger run matrix.
Yes.
Surface numbers.
I think what's notable, and Chris Tuno of the Cardinals, he moonlights with the FBI, but he said at this point in 2011, the Cardinals were 4.5 back of Atlanta. So when you look at that 2.5 back of the Rockies, there's still work to be done. Think back to 20. They were 4.5 back at this point in 2011. Real quick, let's talk about the Lemmings Open, which is coming up soon. Also want to remind you, Triad Bank, official sponsor this hour. Triad Bank, of course, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and they are the friendly bank in Frontenac. Right there on Clayton Road, about a block west of Lindbergh, on the web at triadbanking.com. Been in St. Louis since 2005, owned and operated by folks from St. Louis. So if you're a business owner looking to do a little more business, you'd like to take out a loan, talk to Jim Regna, his gang over there at Triad Bank, because they clearly know the St. Louis landscape. They're from here, doing business here. So stop by and see them. Or if you just need a new bank for all your checking and savings, the friendly bank, that's what they are. You walk in, friendly atmosphere, but also nice folks working there. Check it out, triadbanking.com, or in person on Clayton Road, just west of Lindbergh. Right there in Frontenac. TriadBanking.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And also, Martin, introducing the second annual Lemmings Open on Thursday, October 5th at Aberdeen Golf Club in beautiful Eureka, Missouri, the home of our very own Cam Jansen. The tournament is presented by Bud Light and Gold's Gym and is benefiting Birdies for Bipolar, a nonprofit aiming to raise awareness for mental illness and assist individuals living with those conditions. The tournament costs $500 per foursome, and includes breakfast, lunch, 18 holes of golf, cart, drinks, and trophies for the winning groups. Sign up your foursome at InsideSTL.com and click on the hashtag Lemmings open page.
All right, a quick break. We'll go back, talk some Mizzou football with Dave Matter of the Post-Dispatch. A little later, Bill DeWitt III. We got a concert tonight at Busch Stadium. Billy Joel in the house. We'll talk to BW3 a little bit later here on 590 The Fan.